Hello and welcome to Cage Club, two fans, 76 movies, one cage. Today's movie is The Frozen Ground from 2013. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us back again, Cage Club guest number one, or will be number one in terms of in both in our hearts and in number of times on the show. Well, to be fair, all of our guests are number one.
Yeah, careful.
Everybody shares a number one. But Tobin Addington's back. Hello, Tobin.
Hey, guys. I'm glad to be here. Not necessarily for this movie, but I'm glad to be back.
Now, I will point out to our listeners that every movie that you've done has been your choice. And this was before a lot of these later movies had been taken or been selected. So all of these movies that you're seeing, you wanted to see. And so anything, we did not put you in this corner. By the way, our first, I think, officially straight-to-DVD Nicolas Cage movie.
You made it.
We did not do this to you. You did this to yourself. So any kind of resentment you have toward this movie should be cast inward instead of outward.
Oh, believe me, I'm channeling it in the proper direction. I send none of it to you guys. I look forward to any chance to talk to you guys about Nicolas Cage and about these movies, whatever the movie is. So, no, I am just glad to be here.
So this movie, I guess the big story or the big notable thing of this movie is that it reunites Cage and Cusack from Con Air, but the roles are kind of reversed, that Cage is now the cop and Cusack is the criminal. It's a weird sort of change of pace, but as fun and as interesting and as colorful as Con Air is, this one is kind of the opposite in every regard.
Yes, including not having a fantastic Diane Warren theme song that we can all sing at the end. I mean, thank God it didn't. It would have been completely out of place. But you're totally right. This movie has none of the fun of Con Air, for sure.
Yeah, and it's reflected in its environment as well, right? The dark, cold, dreary land of Alaska. That's not to say you can't have good movies set there and so forth, but it doesn't really help this one to be either. It's just dark as is, and it's not a bright film to begin with.
I don't even know where to begin with this one. Well, so this movie came out in 2013. I guess one other thing I want to say right off the bat is that it stars Vanessa Hudgens as well. This is the same year that Spring Breakers came out. And so these are, I guess, her movies to break free of the High School Musical, the Disney world that she has built for herself. Hmm. And while Spring Breakers is this movie that, like it or hate it, and I absolutely love it, it's this movie that has artistic merit, sort of. You can tell what they were doing there. Here, she's just a crystal meth-addicted stripper / prostitute, and just, talk about the not even Diane Kruger effect, just completely horrible to women. Like, this might be the movie that's, like, worst to women of maybe every Cage movie to this point.
Yeah, the movie does almost seem to revel in the torture inflicted upon the women in this movie, whether it's by the Robert Hansen, the John Cusack character, or by the script. Or drug abuse, or prostitution, or the sort of seedy underbelly of Anchorage, Alaska. There's an ick factor to this movie that does not feel artistically warranted, that just feels kind of icky. And it certainly pervades Vanessa Hudgens' performance. And I don't buy her in a lot of that, so we'll get to it, I guess. But I don't buy her in this in the way that I bought her in Spring Breakers. You liked that movie, Joey, a lot more than I did. But at least it was, as you say, it had artistic ambitions that it was aware of. And, right. And I'm not sure this movie does.
This movie kind of confused me with where it was trying to go and what kind of point it was trying to make. It had sort of that 8mm feel to me, you know, but like Tobin, I think you would appreciate that a little more because of its integrity and its artistic merit. Like, it pulls something mm-hmm. like this off much better, where it does the thing where it's exploring the notion of abusing women and, you know, taking advantage of them and then eventually dying and not objectifying it at the same time. Like, this movie is nuts. It's trying to say, you know, we have to protect these girls, and then it's more sort of concerned with showing strippers and nudity and, right. like, exploitation. So very mixed messages going on here.
So this movie is set in Anchorage, Alaska in 1983. It's based on a true story, which I feel we've had before. We've had we've had World Trade Center, of course. How many, what other based on true story? Boy in Blue. Any others?
Wind Talkers.
No.
Wind Talkers is like a fictionalized version of like a true, you know, based on the Navajo code talkers. So I kind of count that.
Right. Well, I guess also this movie doesn't say based on a true story. It says based on actual events. So that's sort of the same thing as Wind Talkers. It's kind of a rarity here.
Well, and if you, because I was so mystified by the movie, I read a couple of interviews with the director, the writer director afterwards. He had direct access to the guy, the real life guy that Cage is playing here, who has a different name in real life. Like, that guy opened up all his files to him, and they are, this is covering a 13 year investigation in 2 hours, as though it all takes place in one, you know, in 1 year.
That explains so much.
It does, doesn't it? And in one of the interviews, he's talking about, the director is talking about how much he didn't want to do something like Zodiac, where it was month after month and all these title cards saying 6 months later. And
he didn't want to make a good movie.
Yeah, he didn't want to make a great movie. Zodiac is one of my favorite movies, which is why I was interested in doing this, because, you know, I have a thing for true crime and mysteries, and this kind of stuff fascinates me. And so to see it done so artlessly, so a lot of those choices were deliberate on the writer-director's part. You can see where, sort of from concept on, a lot of this went wrong.
What's really confusing about this is that it seems like it only takes place over one winter, and, you know, in Alaska that might be 6 months, but it's also to the point where everybody except for Cage and Dean Norris, Hank Schrader from Breaking Bad, it seems like everybody's just, like, sick and tired of this case. But there's no backstory for why they're sick and tired. It's just we've got to move on from this. It's like, well, why? Like, I don't understand. And they never, ever, ever set that up.
Right. One thing for me that was just drove me crazy early on is almost every scene is sort of this massive info dump, almost done in sort of a walking talk style, or while people are doing other things like jumper cables, and it's distracting and hard to follow. But like, you could tell they're giving you all this information from these case files that they want to squeeze in because it's an actual case and they have the access and all this stuff. And it's just like way too much for me. My head started spinning because I didn't know what facts I needed to keep in mind and what to grab onto, really. Movies like this that are set in these types of environments tend to be slower paced and reflect the environment better, and I feel like this sort of quick paced thing is more of a city type. It's better set for like a city type environment and stuff. So, I mean, I was thinking of like Fargo and Insomnia and things like that, and, you know, they really try to use the environment more as like a character or to sort of just substitute talking too much, you know, for lack of, you know, anything, for lack of a better way to explain it.
What's also weird about this movie is that I forgot for a long time it was in 1983. Like, they don't do anything, I really feel, to prove, like, to set you in that time period. Toward the middle of the movie, Cage is interviewing Vanessa Hudgens and pulls out that gigantic tape recorder. And I was like, oh, right, like, this is 30 years ago. But, like, the rest of the movie feels like it could take place in modern day, I think. Like, there's nothing cool about the era. Like, it's like they made a movie just to make a movie. Like, there's no thought. I mean, we were talking about, I was just editing the Season of the Witch episode, and we were talking about it with Jordan. Like, that movie, there were just no choices made. Here, I feel like there's no choices made. Like, they're just like, all right, like, we have a lot of facts. Like, let's just put these things together and see how things turn out.
Yeah, these are really good points, both in terms of the time period and the location, both of which could have been used in kind of fascinating ways. Like, I never imagined Anchorage, Alaska as having a seedy underbelly, as having a particularly urban area, as having cabs you can just hail on the street. And if that's all true, I think there could be a way where the filmmakers could show us how, here's your perception of Alaska, and then here's what Alaska actually is. And that could have a fascinating thing if they used it, as Mike's saying, as a sort of character, no, not as a character, but as a, you know, used it in the film. And the same thing is true for the time period. And maybe they couldn't afford music, you know, from the 80s. And it could also make an interesting point that in a lot of places in the more rural West, even though this is in Anchorage, a place where I grew up, you know, in the 80s, parts of the town still looked like the 60s. And now, some parts of the town still look like the late 80s, early 90s. And I think that could be, you know, there's a lag effect on things. And that could be interesting to play with, too. They're not underlining anything. They're not making any choices about that.
Yeah, because they don't even really go far with the wardrobe or, you know, hairstyles or anything like that. I mean, there's a few cars thrown in there, but it would have been interesting to play that up a little more just for the background subtext, you know, just to be there, just to sort of remind you once in a while. I also don't feel it helps the way that this film is shot. Like, it's shot ultra modern, I feel, you know, like, to the point of I almost got like a little nauseous at times because of how sort of quick cut handheld it got.
So I think part of the reason that the cinematography or the filmmaking or whatever is so, I guess, sickening or not great to look at is because the director, this guy Scott Walker, has only one other credit to his name before or after. He wrote and directed some short film in 2005, so this is a guy who hasn't, at least professionally in terms of what's on IMDb, had much experience behind the camera. It's weird. I don't know where he came from. I don't know where they found this guy. It's not like a Joel Schumacher like we talked about with 8mm. It's not somebody who's sure-handed behind the camera or with a clear sort of director's vision. It's this relative unknown trying to make a movie.
And from what I read from the interviews, it seems like this is a passion project of his. He sort of went after the true story. He found the actual state trooper. He got all the files. The first things I notice about this movie is that as the credits come up, there are like 8 production companies. You know, I think there are like 12 listed executive producers, which means they cobbled the money together from all over the place to make this movie. This is not a sort of, you know, studio movie that gets somebody assigned to it. This is something that he or his producers or somebody pieced together to get made. And sometimes those turn out to be great films and launch careers. And other times they turn out to be movies like this.
That's a pretty interesting sort of insight into the making of this right there. This is a movie that should kind of work, you know, like, or at least I could see the backer having expectations. You know, you got this true crime, true detective kind of thing going on here. And, you know, Alaska, it's America, but it's also kind of foreign in a way. I mean, it's very remote. It's got interesting things going for it. You've got Nick Cage and John Cusack. I mean, these are big stars here, and then you've got the new breed, and you even got the guy from Breaking Bad here and stuff. So it just feels like the director dropped the ball. Like, that's kind of what it comes down to for me, you know? It's like everything was sort of in play, and he's the one that it all kind of seems to come down to, you know? Everyone's doing what he says, and if you say it was a passion project, this must be the way he wanted it to come out.
If this is the way that he wanted to come out, I do not have any interest in seeing any more movies from him. I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about how poorly this reflects women. The movie opens up with Vanessa Hudgens, and I guess her story is kind of changing, and they kind of see got to discredit her. She is in the police station saying about how she was basically abducted or kidnapped by this guy and raped or consensually had sex, or he went above and beyond what their agreement was when she was a prostitute. In a matter of, like, seconds, the detectives and the cops turn the tables on her and make her out to be the bad guy. Like, she is this victim here, and they're like, oh, you must be a liar. Like, why is your story changing? And it's like, oh, you know, in all angles, not only is she a prostitute and this, like, this basic, you know, an object for us to look down upon, but she's an object who's a liar also, and just we can't believe anything that comes out of her mouth. Nothing about how he portrays this character is redeeming or positive.
And there's no explanation for why they're treating her this way. I mean, they say a couple of times that John Cusack character is an upstanding citizen, but then one of the first things that Cage's crew figures out is that he had a conviction, right, for kidnapping and raping a woman. Like, this is there's so because the film doesn't provide any explanation for why these cops are being so dismissive to her, it leads me to believe that that's like the film's point of view or something. I don't know. I find this sort of this whole thing's kind of bizarre.
Yeah, this setup here was very strange to me. They had the good cop, bad cop, right? But bad cop is like super bad cop. And I think what they want to try to say here is this guy is protecting people, but he has the same point of view towards women as the killer does, basically. But he's on the right side of the law, and he can kind of like not give in to his urges or whatever. But that's one thing I got setting up. And then the other thing I got is like, yeah, they show Cusack. He's basically like the honorary mayor of this town, right? Like, he just like walks into the bakery. I suppose he owns it or whatever. Everybody knows his name. We're told and shown that he's like the greatest guy in the world. So it's weird how they're trying to do like this switchy type of setup, like, oh, we're going to portray the good guys as bad guys and bad guys as good guys, and then we're going to show you slowly like the truth and peel, but it just never jives, or that's not what they're going for, and that's just what I was expecting.
And I think they're setting it up to be some kind of major reveal, right, that this hometown hero, this guy that everybody loves, is harboring a dark secret, and he's actually the killer. But you almost know, just because you've seen a movie before, that there's no way that he's not the killer. Like, I mean, you know from the premise that Cage is the good guy and Cusack is the bad guy. But even without that, they just show him, the second thing they show him doing is just watching really close, just animal programs where animals are killing one another. Like, this guy is met, like, they don't go out of their way to, like, have this be a big reveal. It's so weird. The other thing I want to mention real quick is that when he walks into that bakery, everybody says his name like, hi, Bob. Hi, good morning, Bob. How you doing, Bob? And I just got a flashback all the way back to Rumblefish where everybody said Rusty James' name. And it's just like, we haven't had this much reinforcement as to a character's name in 30 years, but just how everybody said Rusty James every time I mentioned him, everybody here, I mean, it's the only time that I think it really happens in the movie, and maybe that's sort of a northern kind of Fargo, Minnesota, possibly Montana, I don't know, but Alaska sort of thing, where it's like everybody knows and like you just address people by their name. But it was just sort of weird to hear his name, I don't know, 15 times in 20 seconds.
And it's also strange that you get what these scenes feel like, such a small town, and then you get these more urban shots and scenes set in Anchorage, even exteriors, flying over the lights of the city and then down in the urban sort of area. It's schizophrenic that way, right? They are multiple personality or something. Like, it just, the movie does not know what it's got, or doesn't know what to do with what it's got. That it's got this, what could be a fascinating premise, that it's got these actors all the way down to the supporting characters, with some exceptions, but largely the cops and the prosecution, all those people are all actors that have turned in great performances in previous films, and it has this great location, and all of this stuff should really be working in this movie. And the fact that it's not, that just has to fall on the director's shoulders.
One of the things that really sticks out to me is the fact that this was supposed to take place over months or possibly years and stuff like that, and they just really super condense it, and it feels it that way, you know. And they even fall back on the worst cliches, you know, like they just drop a line, like you could tell they wrote it on the day where Cage is like, man, I'm 2 weeks from retirement, you know. They just need to shove that in, otherwise it would have been the first thing he says to his wife before he leaves in that scene with his wife, right? His wife would be like, right, be careful, like 2 weeks till retirement. But no, it just feels like, okay, we need to sort of speed this thing up, give a reason to make this case be solved in 2 weeks, basically, instead. But how interesting could it have been if he was like, yeah, I've got 2 weeks to go, here's a case dropped in my lap, and it took him a year to finish, you know? Like, that would have been much more interesting, and you see it really dig at the guy and destroy his family life and all that kind, and even his career to a point. And in the end, you know, he turns out to be the hero. Like, it would have been a really far more interesting way to go.
Wait, is he retiring in 2 weeks, or are they just moving out of Alaska in 2 weeks?
Well, regardless, it's just like, there's a
closed time frame.
Yeah.
He has a new job. They're waiting for him to sign the papers for his new job, wherever they're going, which is out of Alaska. Yeah. And, you know, the thing that kept striking me after I read this interview is, imagine this movie if it had, rather than run away from Zodiac, if it had leaned into its Zodiac-ness. That could have been the way to make this movie. And the fact that it was set in Alaska could have been enough to differentiate it from Zodiac, you know, like use the location, use these people, tell the story in a more procedural TikTok kind of way. And I think that would have been fascinating. But instead, you get a Cindy going home, and the first thing we see when she gets home is that she's lying on this bed, clutching a stuffed animal with a carton that says milk on it, in bright red letters next to her, and watching cartoons. And you just kind of go, oh, God, really? Okay, this is going to be that kind of movie.
One thing I want to talk about, and it's sort of, I guess it's sort of similar to that. It goes a little bit back to what we were talking about just right before that. We were talking about Cage's wife in this movie. And she is this character who, I mean, the whole thing is, I guess, like they're showing, I guess condensing 13 years into 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever this takes place over, they're showing that like she is tired, that he's so invested in the case that he has no time for his wife or his kids. And so they show it by, like, he just doesn't answer, like, you know, he doesn't call, he doesn't do this, doesn't do that. This wife's arc is basically sort of naggy, 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 and then he brings, which is a crazy twist, Cage brings Cindy home to stay there because he wants to make sure that she's safe, and the wife, rightfully so, is like, no, like, absolutely not, like, we're not gonna have this girl stay here. And then, I don't know, 15 minutes later, she's like, go solve that case. Like, I know this means a lot to you. It's like, wait, what? How does that, like, what is this arc for this wife? It's awful.
It is only convenient. It is all out of convenience. This drove me crazy. This drove me crazy that she is only there to be an obstacle to him. And so I'm like, okay, so fine. We're going to just go with the fact that she so desperately wants to leave Alaska and him to leave this job. Like, I couldn't understand how that could be a deadening thing on a relationship. Fine, fine. And then she completely turns around and said, no, let's stay. You need to keep being a trooper, and I'm going to get my old job back and forget this life that we were going to... Like, it makes no sense. It might make sense if it was years. It does not make sense over, like, 2 days.
Yeah, especially he's so close to solving the case. She doesn't need to go get her job back. Like, they're on the verge of closing the case and, like, moving out of town. Like, just, you know, 2 more weeks, honey. That's all I'm asking for you. But yeah, her turnaround is crazy. She's even, like, buying toothpaste for her and shit like that, and like caring about her off screen, and it's ridiculous to me. What I did kind of get a kick out of, because of all like this fast paced madness, there's one funny ass scene to me where he kind of gathers his crew of troopers in. You know, you got like the dad from Transformers, you got the brother-in-law from Breaking Bad, and they're all in the room, and he's like charted everything out, you know, like a beautiful mind, and he's got like the timeline and the mugshots and everything going on, and like I'm like, okay, I hope they stick with this idea that, like, now everyone thinks he's crazy or, like, he's off the deep end and this and that. But no, they, like, totally roll with him. They're like, yeah, like, we're going to go get this case reopened. We're going to go get search warrants. We're going to, like, you know, we're going to bust this guy. And that's the other thing. It's like, they know this guy. It's like Bad Lieutenant. They know this guy's responsible. They just need, like, proof, which is a very strange sort of setup for a thriller. Like, I'm all about doing it once or twice, maybe with, like, Seven, the way they do the reveal there is interesting, but the reason it works for Bad Lieutenant is because of all the other madness going on in that film, right? That made it sort of so great. Like, it was almost like a joke that they knew who the guy did it and they just couldn't arrest him for it. And here they're like doing that for real again, and it's just throwing me off.
Well, because like what's crazy is that literally 14 minutes into the movie, Cage knows it's Cusack. Like, 14 minutes in, that we're like, okay, here's the guy. Like, we know as an audience, Cage knows he's a cop. I mean, I guess this is 12 and a half years in, maybe, to this 13-year case, but they don't set that up. Like, we're barely into the movie, and it's like, okay, like, this is, like, we're just gonna go after him.
You have anything on a Robert C. Hansen? Grabbed some girl back in 71, drove her at gunpoint, hands bound and naked to Kenai Lake, and then raped her? He got 5 years. He was out in 3 months. Seems he just had a run-in with a prostitute. She told Anchorage police the exact same story. Why isn't this guy on our list?
Like, what doesn't make sense to me, and there is that scene that you just brought up, where people rightfully should think he's crazy, but they don't. But these cops go back and forth so much about whether or not they're going to help him or not. And then, like, at one point early in the movie, they have, like, 600 cases to go through, like, 600 missing persons cases, and it seems like only two cops want to help. Like, it's just, like, him and maybe Hank Schrader from Breaking Bad, or maybe him, but nobody wants to help. And then all of a sudden, everybody wants to help? It's impossible to track why people want to help or don't want to help. Like, it makes no sense.
It hurts me so much that this is so poorly made. It just hurts. I would love to have had a crack at this along the way, because I think it could have been so much more. And I do like, along with the sort of, you know, crazy Cage, I like the competent professional Cage. I like that Cage. I think that he's, you know, he's owning these scenes that he's in. Like, that's, I have no problem with the way he's portraying. And it's amazing that he's able to, for me anyway, to sustain that as well as he is with writing and scenes as sort of not even quite generic, just empty, a void, as so many of these are, you know. But as I say, it just hurts me that's not better made.
Yeah, I don't feel like he's the problem at all, you know. Like you said, like, he almost feels like a glue at some points, you know, in these bad films. Like, it's strange. Like, in a way, though, I do feel like I'm a little jaded on good guy Cage. Like, I was, you know, watching Stolen and thinking, man, the villain in that is much more, that's the meaty role. That would be a great Cage role. And then I'm watching this movie and I'm sort of like, man, like, it would have just been nice at this point for me, maybe, just to see him play the bad guy, especially since the bad guy is sort of very much like the cop. Like, they're both very reserved, have the same type of temperament. I don't know. I think he could have pulled it off, not better, just different. I don't know. It just, for me, it would have been a nice changeup. I've been seeing good guy Cage for a long time now. I have to say, my favorite part of this movie is the John Cusack sort of game room scene with the first sort of major reveal of the girl in his room. That scene sort of felt like it belonged in a different movie at times. I was like, it just had Cusack, this girl, and a camera, and he made that work, and he was sort of scary at times.
Well, what I really like, and we were talking about this off-air, Mike, Vanessa Hudgens at one point tells Cage that, like, she saw something in Cusack's eyes. She knew that he was evil. Like, she knew that she got into trouble when she went with him. And it brings me back to real life, and we mentioned on another podcast, it might have been the Con Air podcast,
yes,
where somebody was talking to Danny Trejo, and they were like, who are you afraid of on that set? Because you have all these big, tough guys, like, oh, John Cusack, you know, he's just dead behind the eyes. And so, like, you know, this mild-mannered guy is capable of this, like, horrific evil, like, portraying this, like, the worst type of person imaginable. and there are flashes, like that scene, you know, like the reveal. Then there's scenes at, like the big, like, what should be, and I wrote down, I think it's like an hour and 15 minutes in, it's like the Heat moment. It's like, you know, you're watching Heat, and you're like, Pacino, De Niro, all right. Like,
oh, yeah.
We finally get it. And then it's like, it's gone before you realize it. Like, here, you're like, all right, all movie, like, where it's going to be Cage and Cusack. They're building toward this scene, and then it's like, oh, this is what we get? It's just, it's awful. And, like, neither of them, like, Cage is like, I guess he's trying to play it reserved and not lose his cool, but Cusack just seems bored, and it's just, I don't know if it's just poorly written, or just cut weird, or what, but, like, this is the scene, like, this should be the scene if this was a better movie. Like, if this was, like, a Best Picture nominee, like, this is the scene that they play, you know, like, this is, like, this is where everything's building to.
Right.
And it's almost, like, the worst scene in the movie, because it's just completely devoid of all emotion.
1971. There was an incident involving a Miss Allen over in Spinard. Can you tell me what happened there, Mom?
Well, I don't know what to say. I guess you could just call that an urge.
And is that to do with what Dr. McManus said at your sentencing?
I can't remember.
Schizophrenic or manic depressive problems? A mental state you would sometimes go into and things would just happen. But then you wouldn't remember. Was he off base on that? Is that bothering you, Bob?
Hey, listen, whatever the problem is here, I want to help you gentlemen clear it up. You know, but by the same token, my lawyer always told me never to, you know. But I can help you clear it up. What's your question?
Well, I think, especially for the Cusack character, my biggest problem and why I feel what you're talking about also didn't work for me is that there was nothing for him to sort of hang his crazy on. Like, I didn't never get a sense of what his trauma was, like why he was a killer of prostitutes, you know, why that was his MO and why he'd like to go out and release them into the wild and pretend like he's hunting them most dangerous game style and everything. I mean, at least in that story, the guy hunting people would like give them a fair advantage and stuff and like make sure they were well rested and had a weapon or something. But yeah, like, we just don't know why he's twisted and evil, and I think it's why later, where he needs, like, those scenes where he's against Cage, I think they're supposed to rely on us knowing why he's crazy, and we're like, oh, look at their facing off, and, like, he's keeping this crazy secret and stuff, but to me, there, it just kind of falls flat, and like you said, like, there's just no energy there.
Well, I think one of the big problems here is that it goes hand in hand with just not knowing his motivation. As a serial killer, he has a type. And they say it in the movie. It's like, you know, girls like 5'2", 5'3", 120, 125 pounds, brown hair, real thin. They get called in on this, like, photography shoot, and then they just get, they're never to be seen again. The beginning of the movie, I wrote down that, like, the timeline of everything feels fuzzy. Like, it seems like scenes are shot in the past. Maybe they are. I have no idea. It doesn't feel like it's a completely narrative, like, through line. It feels like we're flashing back to things and maybe flashing forward, but I don't think it is. Like, I know Vanessa Hudgens. I've seen her in multiple movies. I know what she looks like. But this other girl, the girl that he's, like, actively kidnapped, when she's all ratty and just chained up, like, she looks so similar. I'm like, wait, is this the past? Is this, like, I don't understand when things are happening, which is a very bad sign.
Yeah, it makes the whole movie feel like John Cusack kills someone every weekend. Oh, it's Tuesday night. I'm going to go out and abduct a girl and kill her. And it does such a disservice to the movie. And while there are great things like the reveal of that girl, we see John Cusack alone in his den. And then we're just with him down there playing music for a little while. And then the camera reveals that there's a girl chained up in there. Or the fact that when he gets her out to the wilderness, that he does, you know, play the most dangerous game. Like, these things that could have been even more chilling, or that sort of give you a peek into perhaps what the real life case was like, that could have been used more. I don't know. It's like there's no organizing theme, or there's no point of view in the story. It's just bumming me out. And the score. The other reason that's the scenes between, well, all of the scenes really, but also the scenes between Cusack and Cage. The score is terrible. It's terrible. It's like, it's almost like they found, you know, free music online, like free, you know, cop music, and like stuck it in the movie. I kept writing in my notes, like, this score is killing my buzz. I almost turned off the sound just to watch some of the, but the camera work isn't that much better, so I don't know how that would have helped.
I almost wanted them to trade scores with the movie Stolen, like Tobin, I recommend Stolen. It's like the best of the worst right now for me as far as Cage movies. Like it is just a blast for some reason. I had so much fun watching it, but it's not good. But the one thing that like kept me like laughing was the music and just like how outrageously sort of over the top and out of place it would be and just like sort of inappropriate at times. And here I got the same vibe, but it wasn't making me laugh. It was just kind of making me cringe. It's bombastic at times, and it's just these pounding strings, and it's like, I get it. Like, let's just, like, can we have a little subtlety somewhere here?
What's frustrating to me is that for as poorly made as most of this movie is, there were a couple scenes that I really like, and I don't know that I really like them on their own. I really like them in comparison to the rest of the movie. Like, the first time we're walking down the street in Anchorage, and they're talking about, it's like the Hostro, and it's like, you know, you can get anything you want on the streets of Anchorage. It's a crazy scene, and they're just like basically like swimming through prostitutes and just people like openly whatever, like just crazy stuff on the street. That's kind of cool. Like that scene feels alive. Yeah. It doesn't feel real, but it feels alive.
Call it the track, like for horses, Hostro, for the Hostro. Everyone knows everyone. All the pimps and all the other pimps. Who owns which girls? Which girls are the wild ones? Black girls are boosters, white girls are flatbacks. Good money earning bit can do both. Their words, not mine. It's move and hustle. Give the least, get the most. You know, it's all about the paper. Let's dance.
And then toward the end of the movie, there's another scene where Cage goes to the strip club, and it's set to that hair metal, and he's trying to look for answers, he's looking for Cindy, and it's, again, not great, but it's so much better than everything else that came up to it that it was, like, relatively engaging. If the whole movie had been at that level, it would have been okay. It's just frustrating that so much of it is just, it's not unwatchable, it's just boring when there are these chances. Like, they know how to make moderately engaging scenes. I just wish more of the movie was like that.
Those scenes are by accident. That's the thing. Those scenes just happen. You know, you can feel the and I sort of hate to do this to this poor Scott Walker, who I assume is not the governor of Wisconsin, but the director of this movie is a guy named Scott Walker. But he did this. I could feel the first time director behind the camera just sort of saying, "Ooh, it's in focus." You know, clap, 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 and then like, "Oh, it's Nicolas Cage in my movie. That's great." And then it's like, "Oh, we've got a score on it. That sounds awesome." You know, like there's just no artistry to it at all. So any of those things that happen that are at all interesting, I think they're by accident.
What's amazing about that one scene in the strip club later, Joey, first it kind of reminded me of the scene in Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance, where it's scraping at the door and he just needs information from this guy.
But no, do not compare this to that, because that is fun.
No, I'm just saying the situation was similar, but what didn't happen in that, what happened here is he straight up like manhandles this woman, right? Like basically hits this girl, and it just brought up more thoughts about what is going on with their theme here. Like, you know, they want to be, you know, we're pro-woman here, but yet we have the guy trying to save the girl is beating up a girl. Like, it's just all very confusing to me. But the energy is there. And the energy is also there in the scene you mentioned where they're sort of cruising Ho Row or whatever they called it. And the one thing for me that I kind of get a kick at, one of two characters I really sort of focused on when they were on screen was Cage's Vice Squad buddy, this brick shithouse of a guy. He kind of looked like the Thing to me from Fantastic Four almost. And like, he was just a wealth of information about like the hooker game and the prostitutes and all that shit. And it was like school time when he was on screen and stuff. And my other favorite character by far is definitely whatever 50 Cent is doing in this
movie. Oh, 100%. Like, every time 50 Cent was on screen, I could not look away. And I guess the filmmaker did make one decision, which was to give 50 Cent the most ridiculous wig that I've ever seen on anybody ever. It is, like, when he shows up, like, I knew 50 Cent was in this movie because I looked through it before. But when he shows up, I'm like, oh, there's just a guy. I'm like, wait a minute, that's 50 Cent with a crazy wig. Like, what? I don't understand what is happening, why he's wearing it. He's kind of got an arc as a character, but all I can think about, all I can remember, is that wig. It's crazy.
He's not only an actor in the film, he's a credited producer on this movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, he sort of seems to me to be the only guy, like, actually in character. Like, he looked like a pimp from the 80s, right? That would sort of be stuck in the middle of nowhere. I think of the current season of Fargo, and he's sort of like the only black dude surrounded by, like a sea of white guys, right? Yeah, I mean, he's not nearly as good as Mike, but I give this character, like, a lot of credit for even existing in this movie. And, yeah, I love sort of his Dolomite hairstyle or whatever he's going for with the fried out flat hair and stuff. It almost has sort of a Cage in Bangkok Dangerous feel to it to me. I was just like, it's like the Black Cage almost.
And this is another rapper in the history of Cage Club. We had Queen Latifah back in Bringing Out the Dead. We had Exhibit in Bad Lieutenant. We now have 50 Cent here. I mean, we are picking up. I told Mike.
We had we have Master P in Gone in 60 Seconds.
We had Master P. I really want to put together like a Cage Club like hip-hop playlist, including the end song from Amos and Andrew, because we've got a pretty decent catalog of hip hop stars in what we're doing so far. I have a question for you, Mike. Maybe I'm just forgetting, but like we're getting to the point like after we meet 50 Cent, and 50 Cent, I guess, is Vanessa Hudgens' pimp. This is like her first night stripping. I guess she just wants to make a little bit more money. Is she in financial trouble in this movie, or she just wants money?
Well, I took it that she was sort of like, if Travis Bickle never showed up to save Jodie Foster, like she had been a prostitute as long as, you know, as early as she could be, and just that's all she really knew and everything. So I took it more, you know, maybe I'm giving the film too much credit, but this is sort of what I imprinted onto her character, you know, just the idea that this is the life that she's always known. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, I just think this actress is way too pretty to be playing this character. Yeah. I feel like she should have been a little more busted up. She feels like she kind of stepped out of 2008 or something, you know? That's just sort of what I saw.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel like I don't care how much coke and crystal meth and stripping she does in this movie. I do not buy that she's damaged. Like, the movie is trying to tell me that she is a damaged person, and that because of that, she doesn't want to go home. She wants to stay here and engage in this, in all this, these activities out of some kind of damage or trauma. And I just don't buy. When she's talking about her trauma, I don't believe her. I see a young Disney star trying to shatter her image. And I think I buy her more in Spring Breakers because she's not supposed to have had a traumatic past. It's supposed to be, oh my God, this could happen to anybody, you know, bunch of college girls somewhere. Like there's something, there was some sort of point of view about a generation in that movie. Whereas in this, I'm supposed to buy that she's this damaged, she's damaged goods. I don't see her psychic scars in this movie. And as a result, where the director is telling me that her relationship with Nick Cage is supposed to be the sort of heart of the movie, I'm not buying it because I'm not really buying her.
Well, the other reason not to buy that performance is because their interactions are just terrible. There's that one where they have... Well, here's a side note. Mike, have we ever been in a roller skating alley or roller skating rink?
No. I wrote down roller rink because I
feels just, familiar, right?
It should have been a bowling alley. That's why.
It should have been a bowling alley. It's kind of a scene like Damon McCready and Mindy, right? Like, yeah. It's sort of Big Daddy and Hit Girl. They're sort of, you know, they're at this little table, and he is just struggling to connect with her. I don't know if it's the writing, because I don't think it's the performances, because we've obviously seen Cage do great stuff and other things. This should be a role. I don't know what the problem is. It's a scene where he's struggling to connect with her, but it feels like he's struggling to connect with her not because she's unwilling as a character, but because the script is just like, oh, I don't really know. And I mean, I've said it before, you know, since you brought it up the first time, but like, Toby, you said on a past episode, like, if you want to convey boredom, you don't have to have your movie be boring.
Right,
here,
right.
I feel like it's like the character, like, oh, she's not going to be cooperative, so, like, I'm not going to give this character anything to say. It's like, no, like, have her brooding or have her something. It's just, like, she has nothing to say here. And it's just, like, again, it should be this great, meaty scene where it's just sort of, you know, he's trying to break through her cold exterior, and just nobody has anything to work with.
I always dreamed that one day I would either be a fireman or work with animals. He's so cool.
Where's your family?
Why you want to know that shit, huh? It's just like all the other squares. I got guys asking me all the time what happened, where my folks think I'm at. You want to fuck me? Is that what you want?
No, Cindy, I don't.
You think knowing makes us friends, makes me help you? What happened to your sister? Yeah, see, fuck that. I ain't a friend. I ain't nothing.
I just thought if you might want to go home, maybe I could find a
fuck,
way to...
Fuck, man. Are you fucking for real?
Yeah, all the story elements are there. They're just not used. It's the same as the rest of it. I do think she's miscast. I think she's a fine actress. I think she can be great in other things. I just think this was the wrong role for her.
I do want to point out that this movie, as bad as it is, and especially as bad for women as it is, does pass the Bechdel test, which I guess says something about the Bechdel test, but also about maybe this movie. That she does have that one conversation with the older stripper, or maybe, you know, the strip club manager, whoever that woman is, and they're just talking about, you know, female power. So I guess there is, to pass the Bechdel test, there is a conversation between two women about something other than a man. So this passes that, but it although, is, like, that's sort of the bright spot.
What they're talking about is how to strip for men. So, yeah, well, it's true. It's supposed to be in the most technical sense. Yeah. It's not talking about a man. It is talking about how to objectify yourself for men. And not in a way that feels like really empowerment. So, yes, I suppose that's true. I had not thought about that. In the strictest definition, this does pass the Bechdel test. But I doubt that would stand up in Bechdel court.
Yeah, I think you need to have, like, your clothes on to pass that test, too. Like, they're in their underwear for that scene, and I was just, like, sort of scratching my head, like, all right, I don't know, is she going to be the mentor now? I don't really know what's going on here, but I'll roll with it. I don't understand why this prostitute's back on the street if she knows her killer's out there hunting other prostitutes that look exactly like her. I don't know why Cage is trying to identify with her or connect on a deeper level when all she really is just a witness he needs to protect to put into protection. Could understand if they went with the time jumps, you know, them bumping into each other a few years later, a few months down the line, or whatever, what have you, you know, her turning and wanting to help. But the movie's struggling to tell this story to me. The elements are there. It just feels, watching it, like they don't have enough to say. They're stretching and reiterating and just sort of running around in circles until the end comes.
This actually brings up another point that I want to make, this sort of this scene. And I think they're struggling to connect, and like there's issues here with the script and between the characters and everything. Part of that issue, at least in terms of the story, is because Cage won't tell Vanessa Hudgens about his sister. So I'm glad that for the third time, I think, Cage has a sister.
Mm-hmm.
But again, here, A, she's dead. But B, she's also just an object, right? Like, she's just this thing that propels them forward and is ultimately what helps Vanessa Hudgens open up to Cage. When he finally tells her about his sister, she finally starts talking to him. Again, like, you know, sister's not a very prevalent theme in Cage Club. This is only the third time in 71 episodes that he's had a sister. And here, I mean, she's a dead object. Like, it's horrible.
Yeah, and it kind of felt, like, unnecessary. I didn't feel like Cage was a haunted man by anything. I feel like you give the dead sister to Cusack, and you make her a short brunette. And that's why he's, like, killing these short brunettes, because he's reliving his sister's death. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this now, you know? It's just coming out of me on the fly. But I just don't feel like that was necessary to gain deeper insight into his character. Like, I just sort of just saw him as, at first, the reluctant hero type, right? He was about to move on from this place, and now he's sucked back in, and then this job becomes an addiction, and, like, he can't quit it. And that was plenty for me. I didn't need this dead sister stuff.
Can we talk about the scene where she runs into the moose on the street?
the northern exposure scene.
So I have a few different options. I want to know what's most likely. Number one, is this a metaphor for something? And again, like a couple other movies lately, I feel like the movie's not smart enough for this to be a metaphor. Number two, is it like something surreal or a dream sequence? Or number three, which I feel like, knowing this film, is maybe most likely, do you think that they were filming and they're like, oh, there's a moose on the street, like, let's just shoot a scene around it? Like, what is the scene about?
At first, it wasn't even... I wondered if that was a CGI moose and that's where all the money went. And then I sort of realistically started trying to think about it. And I was like, Joey, you're exactly right. Like, I was like, oh, they're probably right about to start shooting something else or just finished. And someone was like, hey, like, look at this. There's a moose. Like, go run in front of it. And, like, we'll just use it if it comes out. And, like, that's awesome. Like, it's just artistic flair. We could throw it in anywhere and make it mean anything we want to when we're explaining it.
It comes from... because this jumped out at me in some of the interviews that I was reading with the director, where he sort of throws it away a little bit, but If you'll bear with me, I'll read from this just a couple sentences. First of all, he's talking about that roller skating scene, and he says, they didn't go to Skateland, they went to Chuck E. Cheese. Now, just pause. Can you imagine the Chuck E. Cheese version of that scene? Like, in real life, Cage took Cindy to Chuck E. Cheese. Like, okay. Then he says, she would see moose and bizarre things in the snow. And that's all that he says. So what that means to me is that she mentioned once casually to the real life trooper that she once saw a moose in the snow, and they're like, oh yeah, let's throw that in the movie, you know? Like, yeah. the thing that came to my mind was, do you know the movie Collateral, Michael Mann movie, where at one point in the night they're driving in the cab. And these coyotes cross the road in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. And it's a sort of haunting image. And it's something that actually happens. And just like this moose, you know, but that is so, feels like such a part of the fabric of the film. And this moose, you're totally right. The first thing I wrote down was Northern Exposure, because it just feels like it's thrown in for no reason except that, you know, oh, cool, it's a moose.
You know what could have been cool? When these girls are sort of kidnapped and captured, they're kept in Cusack's game room, and he's got all these animal heads all around the room, right? It would have been interesting if they somehow linked it to part of her trauma of being there, like, oh, these animals on the wall are starting to come real, and she sees them, and, like, she could have been one of them or something. Or they could have had the moose without a head or something. Don't know why I'm trying to justify the moose, but it's just kind of fun, too, now, because of just how, like, incredibly ridiculous it is.
Yeah, this is what the moose is a metaphor for. It's the metaphor for all of the wasted opportunities in this movie. Because they could have done something with the moose to make it work in the movie, and they didn't.
It is. It's just weird. Like, it comes out of nowhere and then it's never referred to again. And I guess the playing it into the game room makes sense. It's just not a fan. Not a fan. Then toward the end of the movie, I just wrote down, John Cusack hires Boba Fett to find Cindy. Like, he hires this bounty hunter. He's just like, okay, go find Cindy. And then he's just off. There's things that, like, should be, I guess, big twists or reveals. He corners 50 Cent, and he's like, you're going to help me or I'm going to kill you. And 50 Cent's like, all right, you got it, man, you got it. And then 50 Cent, like, backstabs him. It's like, of course. Like, that's just sort of, that's what this type of movie does. Like, I don't know if it's just because the movie just feels cliche, but nothing that happened here, and there are a couple sort of twists or tense moments, nothing feels surprising to me.
No, as the movie plays out at the end, there's virtually no surprise. And that whole section where he had, like, the idea of sending Boba Fett out after Cindy, because it feels like, okay, we need to have a chase. We need to have some tension. We have to have some guns. What's happened is they have Cusack in custody. That's sort of it, right? Like, in terms of the some of the tension has gone out of the movie at this point. And also because, as you say, the scenes between Cage and Cusack are not great when he is caught. So it all feels sort of manufactured, right? This whole ending thing feels sort of paint by numbers and manufactured in a way that I'm really checking out at this point.
One thing I did really like is that there is the one scene where Cage closes in on Cusack at an airport, and I'm like, oh, Con Air, like, airplanes, airports, two of them. All right, like, that's like that excited me, even though they just, like, he's close but not really that close. That's the only scene toward the end of the movie that I really actually liked.
There's one thing I did like at the end. Early in the film, Cage has met with the sister of one of Hansen's victims, and she gave Cage this bracelet that she says is a perfect match to one that her sister was wearing when her sister went missing, and they believe was killed by Hansen. So she gives him this bracelet that she's got, and so you know this bracelet's going to come back. Well, then when it gets to almost at the end of the movie, and I forget who, one of Cage's lieutenants is telling him that Cage is telling him, find this bracelet. If you find one that matches this, and they say, no, we've not found anything like that. And you think, oh, okay, so that's it with the bracelet then. And then the way that he uses the bracelet he pretends then to John Cusack that this bracelet is the one that they found, which is one of the things that gets him to crack and confess. And I thought that was kind of a neat thing. That's a trick I might steal sometime, because it was kind of a neat misdirection, based, because I don't think anybody will have seen this movie.
It's kind of like planting evidence in a weird sort of way, yeah, but totally. Not, but it weird. Also, what's weird about that scene is that, do they normally just open a door and show? So Cage is grilling Cusack in a really boring scene that we talked about before, and I wrote down, is there tension here? I can't tell. And then Cusack is like, he's starting to crack, and then they just open the door, and Vanessa Hudgens just standing there, and then Cusack goes ballistic. And I'm like, wait, you can't do that. Like, what? I don't, there is no way, no way that that's actually how it happened in 1983. Like, there is no way that that's how it happened. But in this movie, it's like this scene that you're like, oh, like Cusack dropping a hard C and just like flipping out, like, I should have killed you when I had the chance. And it's like, oh, like this is just so he could freak out so it can make it for the movie. In a movie full of things that like are not hard to believe, but like hard to get behind, this is like the most hard to believe thing. Like, there is no way this would have happened.
I'm going to ask the district attorney to petition the governor to reinstate the death penalty. With all the bodies we'll find, he'll get it. So if you don't want to tell us the truth now, we can't help you then.
You can threaten me? You think you can threaten me?
Bob,
you think you know who I am? You don't have any idea who I am. You little cunt! You think you can threaten me with this little whore?
Bob, take it easy.
I should have killed you when I had the chance!
No, it becomes a Law and Order episode.
Yeah, this last entire act is just weird to me. I mean, because like he's like, they, like I did mention Seven before, where they catch the guy early, but this is like, are they trying to do that here? Like, this is not coming across as clever or interesting. The movie kind of, for me, grinded even further to a halt once they caught the guy and like arrested him. I'm like, what are they even charging him with? You know, they're searching his house. Like, that's going on for days. This is so boring. Like, what is happening? Like, I'm just like, I've waited for Cage and Cusack to square right off like Joker and Batman or something. I just wanted tensions to get high and blood to boil and all that kind of stuff. And it, like, it's just weak. And like, I'm just kind of disappointed here. And it's great when Cusack does, you know, finally lose it, albeit out of like the most illogical circumstance I could imagine. It just feels like we got to wrap this up. Like, let's get this going. And like, even further to that point, the movie doesn't even really feel over, right? Like, they drop all this text at the end and rush through what looks like film sequences and just have like still frames, and I'm like, they're just like tired of making this thing. They just want to release this and get it over with.
Well, it gets super, super Law and Order-y. Like, I think like you just said, during the interrogation scene, Cage makes, I don't know, 3 or 4 phone calls to their to Cusack's house. Like, have you found anything yet? They're like, no, we haven't found anything yet. And like, he goes back and like asks him 2 more questions, then makes another phone call. Like, it is crazy. But apparently they're going to charge him with insurance fraud, or like they have a warrant for insurance fraud. They're going to charge him with murder, but the murder charge isn't going to stick. And it's like, oh, like, but you, like, you know, this is the guy. Just like, just keep an eye on them. Like, don't let him get away. Like, I don't know. It's the whole the whole end just seems, it is rushed, but also like way too long. I don't know what the appropriate length of the end should be, but it's not this, whatever it is.
Well, I think it's like I was trying to say earlier, where they don't seem to feel like they have enough story, so they're really stretching certain things out too long, or you know, like I just feel like Cusack should have been released, and they needed to go back to the house and like find that stupid map behind his bed that, you know, oh, by the way, boss, what was that about? I was like, there's this one piece of evidence I forgot to show you.
Yes,
the fucking magic piece of evidence. Oh, thank you. Now we can put this guy away.
His wife said that he read it every night before bed. Like, wait, first of all, why is that a thing? Also, why is his wife never in this movie?
One dinner scene, right? Like, and she's a tall blonde girl, so she's completely against like his type that he goes and murders, you know? So he's got absolutely no murderous intent towards her whatsoever.
Yeah, this is, I bet, where if you could read the actual case files of how this case actually was broken at the end, I bet that would be so much more fascinating than the sort of TV shorthand that they do here. This is all, again, this is almost criminal now, what they're doing to the story at this point.
As bad as it is, you know, I just love it whenever it happens in the movie. I like at the very end of this movie that they fit in sort of the titular line, that Cage says something along the lines of, the ground may be frozen now, but come spring, I'm going to look at every one of these spots. I'm like, yeah. Like, he doesn't say the frozen ground, but it's close enough to get me excited. So in a movie where I really wasn't excited about anything, hearing a titular line twisted around a little bit was all I needed.
Bob, I can't stop it. You, your family, the media... Ground's frozen now, but come every summer, when the snow and the ice melt, I'll keep going until I checked every last mark.
I love that that's the highlight for you of this movie. That's a beautiful thing.
My absolute favorite part at the end here, you know, this is just one of those real life details they put in because it's just so obscure and bizarre. So the guy was sentenced to 461 years plus life.
plus life.
Like,
yep.
461? Like, that just... Is that just like a... Did they add up all the time, like each individual murder would account to? It just seems like so silly. Okay, because it just came across as like silly to me because they didn't round it down or anything.
Well, because they talk about how just kidnapping and killing one girl could get them 99 years. Like, they mentioned that at one point. And so I guess this is just, you know, it's X plus Y plus Z plus whatever, and that it just gets 461 years plus life.
Yeah, yes. I just feel like they could have said he spent the rest of his life in prison. It's just like one of those extra real-life details. Like, why throw that in now when we've been taking liberties this whole movie? Exactly. Just say he got 1,000 years, or like they put him in jail on the moon.
Yeah, no, you're so right. If the rest of the movie had been the Zodiac version of this movie, then give me 461 years plus life. As it is, it's like now you're going to get technical and specific and real all of a sudden after the map shows up like this and the like. Yeah, you can't play it both ways quite so blatantly.
The other weird thing is that at the very end they go through and they, you know, as they're doing this, they're saying what happened to Cage's character, what happened to this character, what happened to that character. Then they have the Vanessa Hudgens character. They're like, this is the first time she's ever told her story. And it's like, well, is she really telling the story? I mean, she's not the one telling the story. They're just basing this on, like, the cases. I don't understand.
Well, I think they're just trying to say, like, unlike Dragnet, like, her name maybe hasn't been changed to protect her innocence. I know, like, this whole time, here's the biggest twist. Like, that's really her real name? I don't know, maybe. It was just kind of super depressing when the whole sort of row of pictures came up there at the end, too. Like, that was, I understand they were trying to go for tribute, but it just, like, kind of depressed me.
Yeah, again, it's like, to my mind, it sort of does a disservice to their memory that it's at the end of this movie that these names show up, you know? Like, it's like they're trying to borrow from real life in a way to make the movie seem better than it was.
Yeah, I think of something like World Trade Center, also based on true events, okay? And you can tell with that film, they tried to take as few liberties as possible, almost to a fault, right? Like, some times. But it works so much better than this because they have faith in the content of the story and everything, or just they know that they have very few beats and very few elements, but they believe in it enough to make it work and to make it interesting and not make it boring, whereas this just ends up sort of fumbling it. Always love when we get a Joey groan at the end of an episode.
So there's not a lot of trivia, believe it or not, about this movie online. I didn't do any research in terms of the interviews or anything like that, so I'm glad we got that little bit of backstory from the two of you. The only real Cage connection here, well, actually, there's two things I want to point out. There's a couple of background actors that have been in other things. The big one is Kevin Dunn, back from Snake Eyes. Kevin Dunn, most notably, in my mind, recently at least, from Veep, plays an amazing character in Veep. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that early in the movie, when we first meet up with Hank Schrader, who, by the way, they call Anchorage Police Department APD, and they call the Albuquerque Police Department APD. And so, I mean, I know he was DEA, so it's not like he was APD, but just, you know, moving from Breaking Bad to this, similar sort of naming institution. But anyway, the first time we meet him, it's on a beach, and it's like a wintry beach, but it's still on a beach. So, you know, we get a little bit of a Cage connection here back to the beach.
That's good.
That's all I got, though. I got nothing else about this movie.
Well, you know, with a year after this, Kevin Dunn plays the major on True Detective for a season as well. Like, it's a similar kind of thing. Yeah. The only other trivia that I wanted to throw in here was that in some of these interviews the director was talking about, I kept reading them because I couldn't believe what was coming out of his mouth, but he was saying things like they were shooting 14 pages a day. Now, if those of you who aren't filmmakers or have not made movies before, you know, on a feature, a busy day where you'll shoot 3 or 4 pages. So it was, they were doing something like 47 camera setups per day on this movie. Now, again, a big day is 12, you know? So 47 is, and he says in these interviews, like, the crew looked at him like he was a little crazy. And he said, but, you know, I'm making my movie. And it's like, oh my God, I can't imagine that you could make anything with much artistry if you're trying to shoot 14 pages in a day, which shows you, I think, makes it clear why there's not more artistry in the film. They were just grabbing stuff as fast as they could get. Now, I'm sure a better filmmaker could make a better film that way, but it didn't happen here.
So was this shoot like 9 days? Like, how long was the shoot?
It was 26 days, but by the end, they only had about 3.5 hours of daylight. So they had to be shooting, you know, like they had to be working around that schedule as well. And I think that they were pretty strapped for money. There are 33 credited producers on this movie.
Jeez.
33. And one of them, so 50 Cent is the one that shows up first in alphabetical order, because of course his name starts with a number. But there's somebody with the last name of Gandhi on the list too, and like, I don't know who all these people are, but it would be kind of fascinating to sort of go through and see what everybody else has done. But yeah, they had to cobble the money together from all over the place, and then had to shoot this thing insanely fast. Like, TV does not shoot for, you know, only soap operas shoot that fast.
It got me thinking while you're talking, like, I recently saw a great documentary called Giuseppe Makes a Movie, starring this filmmaker Giuseppe Andrews, and like, this is a kid, you know, granted he makes a certain type of film on the super cheap, but like, you know, that's the type of guy who shoots like a movie in 2 days, like 14 pages before noon for Giuseppe Andrews. But like, in a Nick Cage movie with John Cusack telling this story and everything, like, slow down, auteur, like, take a breath, you know, like, the movie's not going anywhere, you know, like, it just feels like he couldn't help himself to make this thing, and it shows through, unfortunately, and it's just too bad, because he had the material, he had a shot, it just doesn't fly.
Any last thoughts for either of you?
No.
No, I mean, I guess it's kind of fitting that we finally officially have gotten to straight-to-DVD territory here, and it makes sense. Like, I understand why this one kind of had to skip theaters and get dumped on demand or whatever its fate is. I see that, you know, and then, you know, movies like Stolen or, you know, Seeking Justice and like those things, they had merit. They had, I could see why people gave those a chance over something like this. The competency just isn't even here in the filmmaking style, form, technique. Yeah. Like, it's all just sort of missing.
Nothing redeeming about this movie, really.
You know, the most fun I had with this movie was reading the interviews with the director afterwards. There's a great one on Collider.com that you can find just by Googling Scott Walker, director of Frozen Ground. I would suggest, if you have seen this movie, that you go and read those interviews. He talks about future projects. He wants to do some kind of werewolf thing and stuff. Like, I got more of a chuckle out of that, more of a high out of that than I experienced in this movie.
Oh, man. So I guess, you know, but there's nothing attached to him on IMDb yet, so I don't know if he's trying to scrape together funds or what, but I mean, I guess, like Mike was saying, you know, go the Giuseppe route. Just, you know, find a bunch of homeless people or trailer park people and just shoot your own werewolf movie. Like, that's just what you got to do.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't want to watch it, though.
I mean, I would watch it. I would 100% watch it. I wouldn't enjoy it, but I would watch it. But Tobin, thank you for coming back. You'll be back before too long. I think actually our next movie, possibly. You're back. Is Joe our next movie?
I believe so. I can't really check the list right now.
Yeah, let me. Yeah, so Tobin, thank you for coming back. You'll be back for our next movie, which is Joe. We're taking a little bit of break. We're recording this around the new year, so we're going to take a little bit of break. But the next episode you hear will once again have Tobin, and I can tell both of you, because I don't think either of you have seen it, that Joe is hands down an incredible movie, like one of the best Cage movies, period. I don't want to oversell it, but like, it's like, he's great in it, and like, it's just a really good movie. So as rough as this one was to get through, that one is going to be on the other end of the spectrum, and I'm very excited to talk about it.
I can't wait.
So thank you for stopping by for this train wreck of a movie.
I appreciate it, guys. It's always fun to have these conversations, and I look forward to more, whether the movies are good or not so good.
And I feel like train wreck is even maybe too strong of a word, because a train wreck would be fun to watch, maybe. This is just like a...
Yeah, train wreck implies that there was some kind of action at some point, too. There was just
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So for all things Cage, you can go to cageclub.me. You can read our reviews, find past podcasts, follow us on Twitter, rate, review, subscribe on iTunes. All things Cage at cageclub.me. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Tobin Addington, and we'll see you next time on Cage Club.